for that long and flattering introduction. You know, Maimonides, at one point in his career, set down 13 basic principles as articles of faith or a creed. He was very much concerned with the theological and intellectual content of the faith. And actually, we later poets took this creed and turned it into the hymn, the Yigdal, and into another hymn called Ani Ma'amin, I Believe with Perfect Faith. And as we approached tonight and the course being based on the book and so on, I decided there really ought to be a 14th article of faith, Ani Ma'amin, I Believe in Perfect Faith, in the publication date of publishers, and even though it's delayed, I believe that the book will come. The book will come on the, I'm told now, on the 16th of October. They did send me a little, sheet, because I believe, you know. I'm a simple man, I believe when people tell me things. And they told me it would be out by the end of September, and so I took three lectures in San Francisco and Chicago this week in order to help sell the book and get it going, and I'm going out with this. When they tried to explain it to me from Chicago, from the publisher, I was reminded of that line from Romeo and Juliet, "The excuse thou dost make in this delay is longer than the tale thou dost explain." It has something to do with two binderies that have gone out of business, and I think it has more to do with the fact that the publishing business, because of paper costs and all kinds of things, is in terrible shape. And the book will get here. God will forgive us. How to start. I remember as a student at the seminary, we had to preach to our fellow students, and the worst sermon you ever had to give, they're the first and the worst. And there was a man named Israel Batan who was professor of homiletics at the Hebrew Union College, and he insisted that every sermon have a special form, a text, and three ways of interpreting a text, a kind of peroration. And we had to go in and present him with the sermon before we delivered it in the college chapel. And of course, it's your first sermon, and you pour everything you know into it. And it's an impossible thing to manage. And I remember I worked very hard on this, and everything from Moses to Maimonides to Mendelssohn to me was in it. And I read the thing to him after weeks of work. When it was all over, I looked up at him expectantly. I said, "Well, will that do it?" He looked at me and rather acidly said, "Do what?" I guess the question that you face after you write a book is, what do you intend to do with it? What do you do in the first place? And part of the answer, of course, is the intrinsic fascination of our history. We're a long-lived people. We've been around as long as the Chinese, and probably longer than anybody else in the Western world. And we've not only been around, but we've been visible. Highly visible. A lot of people who have been around, Bedouins, for instance, they're anonymous. Bedouins come and Bedouins go, and nobody except fellow Bedouins recognize them. But Jews have a way of being seen and being visible and getting the source and being creative. Someone said about us, we're like everybody else, only more so. And I guess it's the "and more so" which makes it interesting. But obviously the reason for the fact that, we gave the basis of Western faith to man, that we've had, one-third of the total number of Nobel Prize winners since the Nobel Prize was inaugurated, that wherever we've been, though we've been relatively small, fewer numbers, we have been significant. Part of the answer, of course, goes back to the fact that we felt we had a significant mission. Purpose, the meaning. The miracle of election, which to the Jew is the miracle of God's mercy, stands at the very beginning of Jewish history. God seeks out Abraham and says, you're an unknown Chaldean, get you out and go someplace and become. And along the way, be them a blessing. And at Sinai, we were offered a covenant, a special set of laws, and we said, no, nah, says the Mishnah, we will do them, we'll abide by them. Jews had from the very beginning a sense that they were special. They were different. Not different racially or genetically. We've never made racial claims. We're not descended, as some people are, of the gods. We're not descendants of nobility. We're the descendants of slaves. We're descendants of semi-nomads, the anonymous people who move back and forth on the edge of the Fertile Crescent. A wandering Aramean was my father. Father was an unknown person wandering. When the Jews come out of Egypt, they described as an asaksuf, a motley, a mass, undifferentiated people. But then comes the moment of choice, of being chosen. You call it to fit your purpose. You know, 100 years ago, they used to say, how odd of God to choose the Jews. And the response, I guess, to that is, how odd of Jews one God to choose. You know, it works both ways. And whether it's that we were chosen in a kind of divine act of mystery, or we chose God through the inspiration of the noblest and the best minds of the time, who knows? But what did in fact happen is that we set out on a very distinctive road, and we've had a sense of distinction ever since. There are a number of moderns who find it difficult to, you know, say, praise God to our Lord of God, who has chosen us from among all people. They find something of arrogance in that which they cannot really stomach. I'm not very much troubled by it. I don't like arrogance. But I also don't like and don't think that anonymous people are very, very meaningful. And that somehow in a family and in a community, it's those individuals who feel a special burden, special obligation, whether it's one of character or one of talent or one of person, who are the leaven in the mass, who are the creative people in the social order. And that, you know, that's been us. That doesn't mean all Jews have been good or all Jews have been saintly. I'd be out of business if that were true. It doesn't mean that all Jews have been creative or all Jews have been wise. We've had our fools and our tebbies and our simpletons. It simply means that as an historic people, we've had a sense of an historic mission. And there's always been a remnant of minorities in the people who try to understand what that mission is and to live up to it. So part of the reason that you write a history of Judaism is simply that it's a fascinating one, a significant one. But then you ask yourself the question, well, am I really an antiquarian? Is this really something I undertook simply because it was a good way of dropping out of the immediate problems of the day and finding a refuge in the challenge of ideas of the past? And then I guess the answer is we deliberately chose to write not about politics and community organization and all of that, but that's interesting and relevant in some ways. But we chose to write about ideas, about those things which need not die, about ideas and culture and traditions and values and assumptions and creeds and faith, what it felt like to be a Jew at every moment in our past. And I think the thing that intrigued me in this process is a different question. It's a very real question. I think it's the burning question of modern time. If we understand the past, as I did, as a process rather than a conclusion, if we understand that Judaism is something constantly being evolved as opposed to something which was fixed at one time and, you know, given by God at Mount Sinai and all we've had to do is to live up to certain set rules that were put down there, if in fact Judaism is a process, then the real problem of 20th century man, the 20th century Jew, is what is authentic in the Jewish experience? What does it mean to be a good Jew? I don't mean to be a good human being. That's part of being a good Jew. But what is, when you add the word Jew to man, to person, what are you adding? What is being required? If you look back in our past, you can find almost every attitude that man's ever played around with, or every institution. We've had polygamy as an accepted form of family structure, and we have monogamy, which is authentic. We have had hereditary priests, and now we have rabbis, teachers, which is authentic. We've had a service which is simply pageantry and ritual in the temple, and we have pews and reading today, which is authentic. The Bible calls homosexuality an abomination, and I see that the Union Methodist Congregation has brought into being in Los Angeles a gay congregation, which is authentic. We have separated out men and women and created a mafitza in the synagogue, and we have women rabbis in the liberal movement, which is authentic. And how do we decide? And one of the questions that I'm always asked, you know, is this. There is a group in life today, in Judaism today, which says we're Torah true. We know what's authentic. All you gotta do is follow the Shulchan Aruch, Joseph Taylor's group, compendium of Jewish law in the 17th century. It's all there. Look it up. Any questions? Look it up. All you gotta do is you find the right heading, you'll find your answer. And many Jews, I find, are satisfied with that. And it's attractive. It defines Judaism as something that which is essential, something which is, has an encyclopedia. Look it up. And the minute you try and talk as we talk, in terms of process, in terms of development, in terms of growth, in terms of the unfolding of the religious tradition, we're in a position where we can't say Judaism is. I can always say Judaism has been, and this was what it was like in biblical times, and then it became this way in rabbinic times. But how can I say Judaism is? How can, what can I find which is essential Judaism? A modern man, the modern Jew, has tried two ways to come to some understanding of what is authentic Judaism if he's not Orthodox. He doesn't accept this myth of the twofold revelation and all that comes out of it. The first, which was popular in the 19th and early 20th century, is a school of what I call the essence of Judaism people. These are people who try to, who are good scholars, who are learned Jews and live a Jewish life. And each of them in his own way tried to write an epitome, a handbook, of his own feelings of what Judaism was. And each of them said some interesting things, and most of this material is worth reading. But the problem is that there are no objective criteria by which you can measure what is authentic and what is inauthentic. As an example, we tend to say today that it's authentic that the Jews are a kind of this-worldly-oriented people. But from the beginning of rabbinic Judaism in the first century to the weakening of rabbinic Judaism in our century, rabbinic Judaism has emphasized the other world, life in the world to come. The Midrash constantly describes this world not as an end in itself, but as a corridor into the world to come. And the test of life is not whether you succeed in building the better life here and now, but it's whether you obey God sufficiently here and now to merit passing into the heavenly Jerusalem. Take another example. We tend to speak of Judaism as full body, as not being afraid of the world and the worldly. We rather like the willingness of Jews to take all things in moderation, but not to talk of celibacy, not to talk of prohibition, not to talk of the denial of the flesh, of what we call the whole ascetic experience of man. But in point of fact, from the Nazarites and the Rechabites in the Bible, who didn't comb their hair and didn't drink wine and didn't live in the cities and didn't wear the ordinary clothes of their day, to the people who went out in the wilderness during the Dead Sea Scroll community times, throughout the entire Sephardic tradition, and among the Hasidim, the Pietists of Germany in the 11th and 12th century, and again among the Hasidim, many of them in the 18th and 19th century, there's a very strong ascetic tradition, which looks on the flesh as evil. Or if not evil, at least that which beguiles us and misleads us and trips us up. And which feels that when we condescend to the flesh, it is no more than a condescension. We ought not to be proud of it. We ought really to live a life withdrawn of Torah study or of discipline or of prayer. Now, which is authentic? Now, maybe appreciation is when we're trying it. How do you find what's authentic art and what's inauthentic art, except with the eye of a connoisseur, the trained eye of a person who has simply trained himself in his business and has much to learn can't give you absolute certainty. This is a masterpiece, and this is only second rate. Still in the eyes of the person himself, or herself. So they're this school. Then, interestingly, very early, men in the 19th century recognized the problems. And Hannes Grass, the most famous of the 19th century Jewish historians, wrote a little programmatic essay in 1846 called An Introduction to History, in which he, in a sense, laid bare the structural problems of trying to interpret Judaism in this kind of appreciative way, this handbook kind of way. And what he did, he took the handbook that had been written by the leading scholars up to his time, and he analyzed their conclusions. And he said, what happens is we read into Judaism exactly what we're prepared to find in it. The greatest liberal of his day, who's written one of these books, is a man named Samuel Hirsch. And Hirsch found Judaism to be intellectually oriented, to be this worldly, and to preach a doctrine of hope. One of the great conservatives of his day was Samson Raphael Hirsch. And he had written an appreciation horror of Judaism. And in that appreciation describes Judaism as a full-bodied, completely involved law given in God's grace to man in order to tell man what is true and what is good and to satisfy man as to his needs to get beyond the confusions of this life to the certainties of a holy life. Each of them was prepared to find in Judaism what they brought to it. So although we can appreciate the spirit as academics now, looking at things dispassionately, we need to say, is there any more authentic way to judge what is authentic and what is not? Is there a more careful way, subjective way? The answer that then was evolved, which was attempted, is to look at the history of Judaism and to say, what is it that seems to be the motive power behind the process itself? Can we describe the whole tradition intellectually, culturally, spiritually, and in so describing it, can we find somehow in the process of history itself that which rings of our authenticity? Can we so train ourselves to be Jews that what is Jewish, in a sense, comes out of instinctively? We respond easily to it. And history was approached, this kind of history was approached, an attempt to define what is authentic. I'm not going to attempt conclusions, because I don't think we have conclusions. And obviously this whole course is designed to try and look at what was authentic at various periods of time to see if we can find the wrong things. It's very difficult. I'll give you a metaphor. The Mississippi River. The Mississippi River begins as a small mountain stream with small mountain streams. Clear water. Shallow. Swift running, I suppose. It runs down through about 3,000 miles of the mid-continent. The waters are constantly being refreshed or replenished by tributaries, some clear and some muddy, some rising nearby, coming down from thousands of miles. You travel down the Mississippi, it never is the same, has the same aspect at any one point. It's sluggish, it's swift, it's clear, it's muddy. It's broad, it's narrow. It's hard to know whether the water that debouches at the mouth is in fact the water which emerges at the source. There's been evaporation. There's been backwaters. There have been shallow pools and floods where the water has overflowed the land. You can't say that a molecule of water at the source emerges at the mouth. But the Mississippi is somehow one. We can put it on a map, it is a single thing. It's very hard to say that there's a single thing, a single molecule of Judaism which emerges in Abraham, or even in Moses, which emerges with the mouth at this point in time. Yet, Judaism is one. And Judaism, I would submit to you, is not a thing so much as it is a process. It is people related in family ways, of course, with converts coming in at all times, but people relating to their time and relating to that which is past in their time. It is that process, never a conclusion. And when anybody says to you, this this is Judaism. This is Torah true. Everything else is false. All you can say to him, who's Judaism? Which Judaism? Judaism when? The Judaism of the Baal Shem Tov, the Judaism of Akiva, the Judaism of Moses, the Judaism of Daniel Silver, my Judaism. What are you talking about? And what I'm saying is not simply Reform heresy. In the Midrash, there's a story of Moses coming down to Rabbi Akiva's yeshiva, the school, and in the school, sitting in the back of the room, some of you are there, and sitting with some of you are sitting to the news, you know, saying, what the devil is he saying? And listening to the law of Moses being expounded and saying, I never heard of it. That's not what I taught. And as a matter of fact, if Moses were taken today here and taken to our ark and we unrolled for him the five books of Moses, he'd look at us in absolute amazement. I never wrote it. I never transmitted this in the name of God. There was no Torah scroll in Judaism to the time of Ezra. Mid-fifth century before the Common Era. Moses lived in the mid-13th century before the Common Era. And the scroll, which we think of as full of, you know, the ancient text in its original form, is written in an alphabet which Moses never saw. His alphabet, which we call Proto-Hebrew, was fell into disuse about the 7th pre-Christian century. He couldn't read his own book. I'm assuming he was literate. But he couldn't read his own book. And yet, in a very basic way, it is the law of Moses and the book of Moses. And we're going to try in the course of this, these discussions to define precisely that. Now, what I'd like to do tonight is not to jump to conclusions. It's simply to set the problem, the year-long problem for you. What does it mean to be Jewish? What is a Jewish value? Federations of the community are giving courses and organizing programs, what they call Jewish identity. What the devil is it? They're spending thousands of dollars to create a Jewish identity. They've got the faintest idea what they're talking about. What is a Jewish identity? What do you mean when you say, I want my child or my grandchild to grow up to be a good Jewish boy, a good Jewish person? I want to give them a good Jewish education. What is a Jewish education? Does it mean I want him to know Hebrew? Arab street urchins in Nazareth know Hebrew. That doesn't make them good Jewish boys. Does it mean I want him to learn certain values? Obviously, but which values? Do I want him to learn biblical values? Well, the biblical Bible says that you should stone an adulterer. The Bible says you should burn a witch. Is that what you want to learn? You want to learn Talmudic values? Talmud says many things. Some have very sympathetic vibrations with us, and some less. We'll examine them. We use words as if they have resonances of meanings, and we very much disagree as to what those meanings are. And I think it's very important for a congregation, for a Jewish community, be clearer than it is on what we mean by Judaism. To stop looking at it as a conclusion, and to begin really to look at it as a process. We're Jews. We're Jews because we share an existential faith. We're Jews because we share certain Jewish experiences, but we're also Jews who lived in 1974, on whom all kinds of new forces are impinging, who must relate in terms of the new forces, and in terms of a new kind of person that we are. Heretic. The truism, you can't change human nature. Comment. You can change human nature. Human nature has changed again and again and again. And I think that the reason that the ultimate validation of why we have new modulations, new formations of Judaism, is that human nature changes. A single example, because we're going to talk on this much more. We take it as self-evident that every man and every woman these rights besides life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is the right to make up your own mind. And if we told our son today, if I told Jonathan, Michael, come with me to the Chagrin Valley Reservation, and I'm going to bind you there to a rock because God has told me to offer you as a sacrifice to prove my loyalty to you, to him, and off we go. He's going to say to me, hey, nothing wrong with me. Guy wants to test you by his own skin, your own skin, one thing, not a mine. His mother would be singing in the background, too. Now, the interesting thing in the Bible story is that Sarah doesn't scream, my child, how can you do this to him? And not once along the way does Isaac say, now, wait a minute, Papa. It's you he's testing, not me. Biblical man, in the earliest sense, had very little sense of self. He was a member of a community. The community was everything, the tribe, the clan, economy, agriculture, defense, family, law, everything. He had very little sense. In fact, his whole training was not to condition him to be a rugged individualist, a member of a capitalist social system. It was to train him to be a member of a tribe, to think of himself as performing certain necessary functions within a tribe. And if he dared rebel against the tribe, there was a doomsday law for him. A bing sorero morero, a stubborn, rebellious son. That is, a man who said, I ain't going to play in your ballpark anymore. I'm going to go and find myself in Vermont. You took him, you didn't say to him, I'm sorry I raised you this way, it's all my fault, go and help. You took him to the gate of the city and you said to the judges there, this is a stubborn and rebellious guy, and the judges said, if he doesn't change his mind, kill him. The assumptions of this social order, the virtue, the family, the requirements, because you couldn't survive outside the tribe. You were astray, a danger to yourself and a danger to others. The assumptions of that early social order were all group, collective. And there was a sense of the collective person. And this is true of all periods, all groups in this Bronze Age. When the Trojans set off, when the Greeks set off for Troy, and Agamemnon decides he's better off with sacrifice, he does the same thing that Abraham did to Isaac. He takes it to Janiah, and he sacrifices her. And she doesn't protest, at least not too much. She doesn't say this, you know, I'm not fighting your wars. She's trained from childhood, from infancy, to believe that the collective is everything, and the individual is essentially nothing. The right of dissent is never affirmed in the Bible. Unless we say, well, we've had progress. We can talk about what progress is, but the assumption is that somehow being rugged individuals is better than being collectivized. But I remind you that half the world today is trying to become, to regain this biblical collective sense. And if you read Mao's writings, and he's the most fascinating of all the ideologues today because he's a thinker, a social thinker, as well as a politician. What is he trying to do? He's trying to destroy the sense of self
so that the human being will reintegrate himself not into a clan but into a commune, not into a clan but into a factory system. That everything will be satisfied by the needs of cooperation rather than, you know, don't spend the needs of self.
When you look at the development of our tradition, you've got to ask some very basic questions. Is it necessarily better that we've gone this way? And again, this sense of process is going to, I hope, help us answer that question. Okay. That's what's called in academic circles prolegomena, which means a long speech before the speech you intended to make to get down all the terms of what you're going to be talking about. Tonight, what I want to talk about is not to introduce you to the beginnings of Jewish history, Jewish intellectual history. That Mr. Machinist will do 2 weeks from tonight. What I want to do tonight is to introduce you to what the study of history has meant to the Jew and to Judaism. Essentially, it's a form of an ego trip. Because obviously, I want the history of Judaism to mean something to the modern Jew, and I want to suggest to you what the study of history has meant in the past. Now let me begin with this comment. Jews invented history. And after he's absorbed that and decides that the rabbi doesn't know what he's talking about, let me try and prove it to you. When I went to school, it was still in the days when faith, you know, that thing that you didn't talk very much about except in the privacy of our churches and synagogues, was one thing and intellectual life was another. That's what you're taught in school. And I was taught in school that the father of history was Herodotus. That the great histories of the Persian Wars, which he wrote, are the first real history. So there was a certain Heraclitus, Miletus, I think, don't hold me to his hometown, who wrote something, some chronicles before, some 20 years before Herodotus, but we don't have them anymore. But Herodotus was the father of history. And it took me some years to recognize the fact that long before Herodotus wrote his history, a group of people called the Deuteronomists had written a long narrative history, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, which existed in the Bible, which had been completed at least 150 years before Herodotus' mother conceived him, and which are the first extended narrative history of a people which remains extant, which we know. Now, we've learned a great deal about the literature of the ancient Middle East in recent times. And the ancient Middle East did have chronicles. That is, before the Deuteronomists, there were lists of kings. Hyksos kings, Egyptian kings, Persian kings, and so on. There were lists of the wars of the various kings. You find them on the tomb paintings, the walls of the tombs in Egypt. You find them high on the stone mountains in Persia. And there were an occasional record of the campaigns, a single campaign of a king. He fought against this and this and this city, he took this and this city and this and this booty. But in terms of a continuing history of a people, as opposed simply to the names of the rulers and the wars that they fought, there isn't a single bit of history which antedates the Deuteronomic history. As a matter of fact, the Bible is organized as a history book. Creation, the flood, the patriarchs, the Egyptian experience, the conquest, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. Now, modern people, you and I, came to have history as part of our academic curriculum in elementary school, high school, college, take it for granted. But in point of fact, the ancients were not interested in history, as we know it. And I'm not trying to make the case that the Russians try and make today. You know, we invented everything. Aren't we better than everybody else? Not at all. I'm going to try and show you that the Jews' interest in history was fundamentally a reflex of his religion and his faith in God. The famous history was the Jews' theology. That's the point I want to try and make. And I want to try and make further the point that this interest in history is one of the hallmarks of biblical Judaism. You find it not only in this one long scheme that the Deuteronomists edited in the 6th and 7th century B.C., you find a second history in the Bible, which repeats this history, chronicles, and then brings it down to later date, Ezra and Nehemiah, written by some kind of priestly editor maybe 200 years later, in about the time of Herodotus. You find that when the Jews became independent under the Greeks, the Maccabeans, there were a number of histories of the Maccabees written. You can still read them in the Apocrypha, particularly the 1st and 2nd Maccabees. You find in the 2nd century in Alexandria, there was a Jewish historian by the name of Artapanus, who wrote a consecutive history of the Jewish people from the beginning down to his time. Unfortunately, only fragments are left. And then you find the great traitor historian, Flavius Josephus, who lived in the 1st century, and he wrote the antiquities of the Jews and the wars of the Jews, who rewrote, in a sense, the biblical Maccabean history down to this time. Biblical man was fascinated by history. The question is why? Why did the Jew invent history? And the answer, I believe, comes from the recognition of the difference between paganism and Judaism. The pagan, and by that I mean any group of people in that part of the world who worship the many gods, was essentially a pantheist. The god God's work in nature and the animating force of natural phenomena. It was scientific to believe in many gods. How else explain the miracle of nature? That the sun hangs up in the sky and moves, disappears and reappears. That the moon hangs up in the sky and appears and grows, waxes and wanes. How explain the river? If you look at the source, it bubbles endlessly, it seems to, but you know from science that if you take a picture and you turn it over, it'll ultimately come up dry. But the fountain seems never to come up dry. Ancient man could only believe that there was a mysterious power within all these great phenomena of nature. He called these powers God. He was impressed by the cyclical nature of the seasons, day and night, all the phenomena of the world. And so he tended to think of his gods as relatively predictable. He tended to think of history as cyclical, an endless spinning of the wheel in place. You see those brooches where the serpent has caught his own tail and the bracelet has caught his own tail in his mouth? That's the ancient view of history. A circle, an endless circle. You're always coming back on yourself. That which has been is that which shall be. That which has been done is that which shall be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Greek, Persian, quite as many places. Now, the gods are in history. The gods are the great predictable force, the miraculous force of all that we see. At the same time, they're unpredictable. There are tempests and typhoons and tornadoes. There's premature death. There's a flood. And so you have the great myths of the gods, which explain in a very graphic way both what you can depend on and the fact that ultimately the gods are not dependable. And no assumption is made about the relationship of what we do and what the gods do, except that hopefully if we placate the gods through sacrifice, the gods will be good to us. And that's the pagan view, the scientific view of their time. Jews came along and did something to this view. They turned it upside down. They took God out of nature. God ceased to be creation and became the creator. He was now the creator of all things, not the things themselves or the animating spirit within the thing. God is no longer in nature, he is above nature. And what happens when you come to this position? Nature, the world, the universe, must in some way correspond in its activities to the will of God. It ceases to be unpredictable. You have a problem explaining how the unpredictable in nature somehow conforms to the will of God. But everything now can conform to the will of God. There is purpose to life. That's basic to the biblical view. There is purpose to life, God's purpose. What is that purpose? That purpose is for man to be obedient to the will of God.
The great mystery of the Bible is the mystery of the election of Israel. The great assumption of biblical man is that God has made a covenant with Israel, with man. If you are willing and obey, you shall eat the goodness of the earth. If you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword. There's a compact. If we obey it, all will go well with us. If we disobey it, we're going to be punished. We, in a sense, are collectively, a nationally, at the beginning. Now, what we have in this worldview? We have the assumption that Israel's history is somehow significant. That God has, at a moment in time, revealed himself within creation, at Sinai, made his will clear, that he has a special relationship with Israel, which is sanctified historically by a moment of redemption, the Exodus from Egypt. And that he has a purpose for Israel to live by its law. And if Israel lives by the law, all will be well with them. And if they don't, they're going to be punished. Now let's examine what that means. That means in the first place that history becomes piety, a form of piety. If you look at the ceremonies and customs of biblical man, all of them resonate with the history, the remembrance of the history of the Jews. Zechor Yemot Olam, remember the days of old. This is Sukkot. You walked in and you saw the Sukkot. The earliest Thanksgiving holiday, Deuteronomy tells us, you have to take the
first fruits of your field, and you go to the altar, the shrine, and you're to repeat this formula. My father was a fugitive Aramean. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers, and he sojourned there. The Bari became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried to the Lord, and the Lord heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. The Lord freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm and awesome power, by signs and by portents. He brought us to this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Wherefore, I now bring the first fruits of the soil which you, O Lord, have given me. The Jew prayed history. There was no prayer book in our sense in biblical times. There were a series of covenant renewal ceremonies, of historically oriented celebrations, of acts of this kind in which the Jew came and he rehearsed before God, he memorialized before God the great acts of history. You heard our cry in Egypt. You brought us out of Egypt. You gave us the law. You brought us to the promised land. The closest parallel we have to that is the Seder, Dayenu, where one by one we list the glorious acts of God, as if we were there, we were part of it. To the Jew, history reveals God's redemptive power to Israel. He saw God not in logical arguments. There is creation, cause and effect. There must be a first cause, therefore a creator, therefore God. He saw God in history. How the Ten Commandments begin, I am the Lord thy God, not who created the world, but who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. History was a revelation of God's will to save, and religion, dear friends, deals not in ethics, ultimately. It deals in salvation, in redemption, in the promise. So he rehearsed history. He created history as a form of piety. He created history as a form of pedagogy. Form of preaching. That's what the prophet did. If history is the revelation of God's will, if God controls history and history is a reflex of God's judgment on the nation, on us, then I ought to be able to read all of history in order to draw lessons from it. If the country is prosperous, obviously they're righteous. If the country is insecure, beset by enemies, there's sin in the country. What did the prophet say? You are sin, you are unrighteous, therefore all these afflictions have come upon you. If it wasn't prosperous, it wasn't a big nation, they found pretty good, plenty of evidence to prove, you know, their case. And when ultimately the exile comes, what do they say? Repent, atone, and God will return, allow you to return. And when they do allow the people, God allows the people to return, it's taken as an example of the fact that they have atoned. They are now one again with God. So all of history is read as a moral lesson. And there are still today, and there were still Jews who looked on the Holocaust and said, for what sin of ours? Who could not believe that there is unmerited violence. That things can happen to me that I don't deserve. I hear it myself again and again. Somebody dies in a family. And one time out of two, I'll hear somebody in the family say, why did it have to happen to me? What did I do? Very basic human feeling. It's Jewish. Or it was. What did we do? That's the way the Jews read their history. What did we do to deserve it? So history is piety. History is pedagogy, and history is the promise. For the pagan, there was no hope. All pagan philosophies are pessimistic. You can only hope to survive, not to be hurt too much. That's the highest of all pagan philosophies, Stoicism. For the Jew, there was hope. Why? Because God controlled history. God's control of history meant there was the possibility. His care was providential. There was a hope. In the end of days, you know those great visions of the prophets. So history performed a critical function for biblical man, and he organized all his thoughts around the history of his people.
And then a strange thing happened along the way into our destiny.
With the end of biblical man, Jews, an occasional medieval martyrology, a list of the unhappiness, the oppression, the persecution that came on the Spanish Jews or the Rhineland Jews during the Crusade. But no history as we know it. Now, how is it that a people so fascinated by history, to whom history was so important, suddenly lose all interest in it? It's an interesting question. And the answer, I think, lies in the fact that Josephus lived through one of the great traumatic events in our times, the destruction of the temple. And with the first and second century, a whole series of disasters occur to the Jew. He's pushed out of history. He's pushed into something called the galut, exile, an indefinite sentence. In 70, the temple is destroyed. In 115 and 117, the diaspora communities of the Jews, Cyrenaica, Cyprus, Alexandria, have rebellions against Rome. They're bloodily suppressed. In 132, 135, Bar Kokhba's rebellion, bloodily suppressed. The Jews enter the Common Era, representing 20% of the Eastern Roman Empire in population, an expansionist, hopeful kind of community, making converts among the upper classes. By the end of the second century of the Common Era, a community which perhaps had numbered 8 million people in the year one numbers less than 4 million people. A community which had its great shrine in Jerusalem is no longer allowed to enter the city of Jerusalem. A community whose great centers had been in Palestine is no longer allowed to live in Judea. The scattering, the galut, has begun. And with the diaspora, with the exile, the Jew becomes like a prisoner who's sentenced to an indefinite period in prison, endless period. And after you get in prison long enough, I'm told, you lose all sense of the distinctiveness of any day. Any day is like any other. The only thing that you live on is not the dullness of the moment, but on what you remember from what it was like when you were still free as a child, and what you remember, what you think it's going to be like if you're ever freed at the end of your sentence. The Midrash and Messianism. The Jew lived in biblical days when he was a free man, full-bodied, and he lives in the end of days when the Messiah will come and he'll again be free. He can accept history, he can accept life on this level. But history, he can't draw any lessons from history anymore. It's too brutal. What am I going to say? That I deserve what's happened to me? I'm a 4th century Jew. For 300 years now, my people have lived in Galut. What did we do? Were we so evil? Are we so blind? Are we so obtuse? Are we so benighted? Are we so corrupt? I can't believe it. All around me, I see the Romans and the barbarians, brutal people, bloody people, cruel people, venal people. They're the rod of God's anger, and I'm being persecuted. How can I explain it in terms of the old covenant kind of system? So what happened to history during rabbinic times is it went up to heaven. The Jews assumed that there was a book. And in that book, all of history was written. And God had written the history of what was and is and will be. And the whole literature called the apocalyptic literature had been developed and was read. Which is, imagine that Elijah and Enoch was allowed to go into heaven to read this book, to know what the future history of the world will be, the messianic time, the messianic coming. But the history's already written down. What I do, what we do as a nation, no longer is the critical issue. The critical issue is what's God written down. So history is up in heaven on one track. And down here on the other track, I live in an ahistorical time. My fate is no longer dependent upon what I do in a national sense. It's only dependent upon what I do in a very private sense. So that biblical man had no sense of personal immortality, or no real sense, a sharp sense of it, certainly no sense of physical resurrection of the body. Rabbinic man emphasized the rewards which lie beyond the grave. And God becomes the merciful God who will bring the Messiah, the judgmental God of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, who shall live and who shall die, who for destruction
and who for life eternal. And the whole basis of faith for rabbinic man is to pray for the coming of the Messiah, and at the same time to live in such a way that his own life merits the Chiyat HaMetim, resurrection, renewal, and some better existence. Biblical man is fascinated by history. Rabbinic man is indifferent to history, and he remains so. Almost no practicing Orthodox Jew has really worked in the field of history until the last 25 years. Just wasn't there mitzvah. The modern Jew returns to the fascination, but in a totally new way. If you don't write history for 2,000 years, what happens? You essentially lose all sense of time. Everything comes to seem eternal, as if everything had been given to Moses at Mount Sinai. When a Jew emerges into modern life, there's a vague kind of assumption that everything is always as it's always been, because there hadn't been much change in Europe. And so there's this great weight of the tradition. And the first thing that history does, besides putting the Jew into the curriculum of the secular world, that is, the world outside of us was fascinated by history, therefore we are fascinated. But from an internal point of view, the first thing it did is it gave us an insight with which to dissolve the basic assumption on which orthodoxy rests, that it is a description of a conclusion given to Moses on Mount Sinai as to what Judaism must be, that it can be nothing else. And during the entire 19th century, men wrote history which essentially changed the self-understanding of the Jew to the point where we saw that things arose, changed, and were renewed. That rabbinic Judaism was as much a reform, a heresy, as liberal Judaism is to rabbinic Judaism, when you put it against biblical Judaism. We began to see that what we took as Jewish customs may not have been that at all. That the famous Bar Mitzvah was a borrowing from the Lutheran Church in early Reformation Germany. That most of our wedding customs came out of the European general environment and were not innately Jewish, that our melodies were borrowed from hither and yon and back again, that we could find elements that are basic, but then we had problems. And the real problem that we faced, and I'll come back to that in a moment, is the fact that once you put things on the sliding scale of history, you're on a very slippery ground. Because what then becomes the principle of authenticity? Well, the early reformers sometimes seem to act as if the older something was, the older you could trace it, the further back you could trace it, the more worthwhile it was. What they're trying to do is to dissolve Talmudism. So if you found things in the Bible, you were in good shape. But there's a practice in Judaism that if a man dies, his brother has the responsibility of marrying the widow. And if he doesn't want to exercise that responsibility, he performs an act called chalitza, and that is the exchange of a shoe, which is a form of contract breaking and contract making in the ancient ages. Now this is biblical law. It's practiced throughout rabbinic times. There are still people who practice it today. If you want to think for the famous metaphor of the rabbi who said, there are silken threads that run through the entirety of our tradition. Well, it's a silken thread that runs the entirety of the tradition. It doesn't say a thing to me. I don't like it. It seems inappropriate. But it's there. If I say I'm going to believe what's in the Bible but not what's in the Talmud, I'm going to end up with a Salem witch burning and a public execution of, 99% of certain congregations for adultery. 97%, 80%, 60%, whatever it is. Historicity. That is, the danger that if everything is in process, nothing is a constant, is the great problem that the modern Jew faces. He's rediscovered history. He's rediscovered process. That's the very basis of 19th and 20th century thought, Hegel, the dialectic, etc. But it's a very difficult thought for most of us to deal with, because it insists that there are no answers. Fixed, final, simple. this is the only answer we really have. And we've got to apply it to the problems of our day. A modern rabbi is different from a medieval rabbi, in that the medieval rabbi said Judaism is, the modern rabbi can say Judaism was, and this is what they were struggling with, and then essentially we've got to engage in a dialectic, an intellectual process of deciding what Judaism is today. And nobody likes answers like that. We all want conclusions. Got a problem? Have somebody, an expert, to solve it. A Jewish problem, the rabbi should solve it. The only growing, as I told you often, the only growing element in Jewish life today is the Orthodox group, because they solve problems. But to do so, they've got to blind themselves deliberately and consciously to all the testimony of history. You can do that. Whether you want to do that depends on the kind of person you are at base. The degree of change that should take place will depend upon the particular situation in which you find yourself. But that change must take place, I suggest to you, occurs because modern man is different than his counterpart. One example, I conclude, and we'll get to the question. In the rabbinic tradition, woman is a species apart. She's a person, but she has a sex-differentiated role. She is to be the Ishit Hayil, the great woman of valor, you know, the last chapter of the book of Proverbs, who looks well to the ways of her household, who sees to it that the blankets on the bed and food in the larder, that the children are neatly dressed. This is her function. She had no function as such in the synagogue. She was looked upon as a distraction, that she was kept upstairs and behind. And more than any other tradition, our tradition respected the woman. There was no denigration of the woman. There is no history of wife beating among our people. There's a great tradition of women owning property, managing businesses, doing many, many responsible things. But the idea of sex-differentiated roles is basic to the tradition. Modern times, we have a new kind of concept, a person, rather than a sex determining one's role outside or even inside the home. And we have this because we have a new kind of society, a society which tolerates education, where people are not immediately put into sex-differentiated roles after infancy. They're schooling. We school people identically because we're not talking about brute labor. We're talking about the mind, the spirit. And the mind and the spirit are not things which depend upon heavy musculature. They depend upon other talents, other abilities. They're equal. And the liberal tradition responded to this new sense of person at the very beginning. The first creation of liberal Judaism was confirmation. And confirmation was created, why? So we wouldn't have a sex-differentiated rite of passage, the bar mitzvah. So we would have a similar school, a religious school, where men and women, young Jewish men, young Jewish women, would grow up to be Jewish persons. And we had the confirmation, we had the school. Women suddenly became melamdim, teachers, which had been a uniquely male preserve. Women were educated universally for the first time. And then you move to women conducting the service, women assuming office in congregations, women becoming cantors, rabbis, what we have today. Most of us find the sex-differentiated approach of rabbinic Judaism totally unacceptable. It's just not our way. We are different kinds of people, attuned with nature, which have been tuned to different needs and different kinds of responses. But interestingly, during the entire 1800 years of the rabbinic experience until the emancipation, there's not a single evidence that women were unhappy with this sex-differentiated role, or that men were. There's no woman's rebellion in Jewish history. Why not? Why didn't we have a woman's lib until the 20th century, the 19th century? Not because women were less worthy, or there weren't women who were strong, and women who had good minds.
but simply because everything in the culture, from the time you're weaned through whatever education you had, through your role in the social order, everything's inspired to tell you this was the natural, the normal, and the right way. And there were enough social satisfactions so that you didn't feel deprived. The new vista hadn't been opened up. The new need wasn't yet there. Now, the need is there for us. And today, an orthodoxy which maintains the old sex differentiations is male and chauvinist. It wasn't 200 years ago. It is today. And in a sense, we've got to create, we are creating, the Jewishness is emerging, the Judaism is emerging, which will respond to the new us, even as I was responding to the new Jew at every generation of his past. Well, I tried to take you down through three big swatches of Jewish history to show you what history has meant to Jews, or not meant to them in each of the periods. I hope to give you a little insight for these three periods. You've been very patient, and now's your time to talk back, and I'm open for questions. Yes, sir. Mark. He couldn't read it.
And one of those books, he wouldn't know what it was all about. And I would like you to define that. And if I may, I would like to ask you a second question, which you can answer the second time around. I would like a definition of who is God.
Taking the easier question first. I don't, you know, I've never been introduced to God. God has been my understanding, the creative force of the universe, whose creative power is somehow personal, responsive to a benevolent will, creating conditions of possibility. And that's all I can tell you about God. I can tell you what others have thought about God endlessly. But that's all I can tell you. Now, about Moses not being able to read the five books of Moses, that's a simple historical fact. We don't know exactly when the five books of Moses achieved their present form. The first we hear of a book, scroll in the Bible, is when in the 7th century, in the late 7th century, around 621, a scroll of the law is found under the temple during the rebuilding of the sanctuary, the refurbishing of the sanctuary, during the reign of King Josiah. And scholars believe that this scroll was part of what we call now the Book of Deuteronomy. We know that some 180 years later, in 444 B.C., the scribe priest Ezra, recently returned from Babylon, brought with him a scroll and read that scroll out to the community of Jerusalem, and they said, "We assent to it again." Now, since he read it during one day, we don't think it's the whole scroll as we now have it, but it was a scroll of the law of Moses. What's in this book? The records of the patriarchal histories, oral records which were set down, some of them in the 8th and 9th centuries B.C., some in the 7th and 6th centuries B.C., histories of the old peoples, and laws set down in various forms, not all of them equivalent to the book. Some of them are priestly laws that come from the shrine, oracular decisions from the shrine. Some of them are legal systems that were, the law was organized by the priests, and the legal codes were kept in the shrines. And they assumed, because they were kept there, they got the aura of sanctity. Some of them are re-editings of a number of older codes. And all of this was re-edited several times in the tradition.
Now, Moses himself, we know nothing about from contemporary sources, except from the Bible tells us. The Bible assumes that Moses received the entirety of the five books of Moses, including Genesis, you know, at Mount Sinai, including even the paragraph in Deuteronomy which describes his death and his burial in a place that no man knows until this day. But be that as it may, that's piety. That's not history. In the time of the first temple, there was for sure, in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, some tablets of law, whether they were the Ten Commandments or more commandments or more than two tablets. Tablets are simply the common form, the stele form, in which the ancients kept their law. And gradually these forms grew, and these texts grew and were added to, and that's what became the five books of Moses. And that's why I say Moses would never recognize them. And I said he couldn't read them, because they were written in an alphabet that he didn't understand. He had never seen it. It was developed long after he died. That's why he couldn't read it.
I want to ask you, Dr. Rabbi, that you mentioned about Jewish identity and to be a good Jew. Can you a little bit more talking about to be a good Jew and identify the question?
I can try and identify the question. I don't want to try and identify the answer. If we were to take a sociological poll in this room, what do we mean by a good Jew? I'm sure there's some who would say being a good Jew is proven simply by what I do outside the synagogue. A lot of people come and tell me, I'm a good Jew, that means I never go to temple, but I pay my taxes and I give the United Torch, or UJA, and I'm a person of character. To some, being a good Jew is somehow measured by the degree to which they obey the Talmudic law, the rabbinic law. To some, being a good Jew is to be involved actively with the ongoing problems of the Jewish community and Jewish survival. There's some who define being a good Jew today as having nothing to do with Judaism and being out there with the Third World or some other movement and promoting the revolution. All these are, you know, are existing definitions. My own feeling is that there is a definition. There's simply a way of going about defining it. And I think it works this way. This is a process. Individuals grow, change, their needs change. Here the time in which they live. Very different from each other. All things are constantly moving on. Now, a person who ceases to be a Jew is a person who relates to the time but doesn't relate to the ideas up here. A person who continues to be a Jew somehow keeps his tension. I'm not very much impressed by the Judaism today, those who define Judaism as radicalism, you know, as a kind of social action without any kind of concern with the existential fate of Jews. They define it this way. I am involved with people who do it this way. There's a third kind of person, the person whose only interest is this, who denies that this change is in fact taking place. And that's the Orthodox tradition. Now, everybody has his own variation on the theme, and everybody's made compromises with the theme. But I would give you this as the model. And I'd say that somehow, in this three-level tension, the answer must come. If you leave out any one of the three elements, you're somehow unbalancing the equation.
Judaism is
a change that you describe it. And where is Judaism and time different? Because the Judaism up there is changing as the times are changing.
So the Jew change. It's all in process.
So
it's a good question. What is static? Let me try and show you what I think happens here. Let's take just the one line of Judaism. Okay?
try to understand them. And I think it looks particularly at four things, all of which happened within 40 years. The Exodus, Sinai, the trek, 40 years in the wilderness, and the Promised Land. Now, I'm leaving out things like calendar, shrine, because those tend to be institutional and objective. They tend to go on. But if you want to know what the value matrix of Jewish life is, it somehow is involved in a Jew understanding those four elements, looking back at them and trying to make sense of them for his time. The Exodus, what does it spell? It spells the fact that man is meant to be free, not to be a slave. It's a protest against all forms of political tyranny. But it's more than that. It's a statement that God participates actively in the redemption of mankind. God has freed the slaves from Egypt. It is also the statement that God has a special relationship with a special people, the Jew, and a special mission. And, you know, they came out for a purpose. It says something about origins. We're the one people without a kind of racial arrogance in our origin. We're humble, slaves, come out of the slave camp. It says something about the possibility of life. Man isn't made to labor endlessly in somebody else's building projects. Man can hope. A people can be saved. How do you define all those elements? Each Jew, each time will determine. Sinai. Man is not meant to be live in an anarchic society. There must be a principle of social organization. There must be a law. That law is both universal in part and special to the Jew in part. There are laws for all and there are laws for us. Law and order are basic responsibilities of the social structure. It is God's law, not man-made law. Law and order and justice are assumed to be synonymous terms. But they have a certain value. Without law, a people is a motley. With law, they become a community. With law, they can move forward. There can be hope. Life is not aimless. We're not left completely unclear as to what we must do. God has somehow entered history long enough to define right and wrong, to make clear that there are righteous acts and there are sins. There are judgments that can be made. You can't live as a Jew in a society which says all is anarchy, life is absurd, judgments can't be made, whatever I do is all right. That's all implicit in Sinai. God's revelation, God's existence, God is the lawgiver. The trek. We're on our way, but it's a long way. And we're never quite going to make it. We never quite cross over into the promised land. Generations must be prepared to sacrifice themselves, to pioneer, to struggle. There ought to be a visible presence of God in the midst of the people, the sanctuary, the Torah, learning. All these things are in the trek. And finally, the promised land, the sense that there is possibility, but it's not paradise. It's got cities that have to be conquered and people that have to be subdued and farms that have to be cleared of rock and all the things any normal life has to face. Hope, however, a strong theme of hope. And somehow in reflection on these basic themes, the Jew has constructed the matrix of values which have remained with him. He's given them very different emphases at very different times, but they're there.
I'm a little bit disturbed by your presentation of Reform Judaism as that we're the only really enlightened people who see Judaism and see history in terms of the present day and in terms of Judaism, and your representation of orthodoxy as a monolithic thing. Orthodoxy is divided in itself and its belief and its concept of Judaism and how it relates to the present day. As reformers, among all the reformed synagogues or temples in Cleveland, you'll find varying degrees of belief and varying degrees of service and whatnot. And the same is true in Orthodoxy.
No, the same is not true in Orthodoxy. 2 points, but one. I'm not making the case that Reformed
Judaism has the answers. I don't even believe that Reform Judaism has any answers today. I think that what we have today is an American Judaism, or, which is trying to find answers appropriate to our people in our times. And I don't think there's a very great difference between Reform and conservatism and these things. It's only a matter of degree. And, don't be surprised that there are differences in outward manifestations or in institutional structures, because we live not in a homogeneous society. We're under tremendously different social and cultural pressures, and all of that is reflected in some of the confusions of our time. Secondly, it is not true that the Orthodox synagogues differ from each other in substantial things or in their approach. Where they may differ is simply in the minor area of minhag, of custom. Halakha, the law, the all-embracing rabbinic law, is equally obligatory on all congregations at all times. Now, there are cases in Cleveland where they tried to adjust to modern times and then were pulled back. There were synagogues which didn't have the separation of men and women with an actual fence, and then when Tel Yeshiva came in, the fence went up. Which is to say that the power is the power of the past, not the power of adaptation. It is true that there was a principle of adaptation within rabbinic Judaism, case law, constitutional process, that worked fairly well when change was fairly modest and it took a long time for any change to surface. Rabbinic Judaism of the 2nd century A.D. and of the 18th century A.D. is a slightly different thing, but it is different. But when the cataclysm of change took place in the 19th century, when the Jew moved often from the medieval world to the 19th century in 6 weeks, from the time he left the Bialystok to the time he landed at Ellis Island, it was no longer possible for these processes of slow, painful adjustment to take place. And they couldn't adjust to modern life. And what happened is you've got a shell-shocked tradition, which became so frightened of change and of all these terrible Jews who were changing things far too easily, and there's some truth in that. They said, we've got to put a stop to all this, and they became, instead of being simply traditionalists, they became obscurantists very often, or obstinate.
Hold on, I asked you an unanswerable question, but I'm curious.
All these questions are unanswerable.
I'm curious about when you were contrasting the polytheism of the pagans versus the monotheism of Judaism, if there's any evidence or information bearing on the origins of this, how did it happen that this particular group, or any group, would even conceive of such ideas that were totally foreign to the experience beginning at that point?
Question is, how did it happen that Jews conceived ideas that were different from the ideas that were general in their world? And that's a very difficult question to answer. I've always been intrigued by the fact that you have English literature. And I confess that I can't read Chaucer in the original. And 100 years or so later, we've got Shakespeare. At the very beginning of the development of Western literature, you have suddenly a confluence of creative force, which a genius takes, but it isn't simply the fact he's a genius. Other things obviously have been bubbling underneath. And you have really the development of vast new dimensions of literature. How do you explain creativity? I suspect that it's in part because they were sensitive to certain things, and in part because they were blind to certain things. Most of the biblical insights were bad science in their day. It made no sense in their day to say that we have all one Father and one God has created us all. You know, Aristotle, 1,000 years later, was still saying the slave is a living tool and the non-Greek is a barbarian, is an ape. Now, he's certainly not a dope. You know, he was a brilliant analytic philosopher. Why was he saying it? Because there were gross, manifest differences between Semite and Black and Aryan. Language differences, custom differences, differences which are as different as between a Labrador and a shepherd and, other kinds of animals. Looking at their world, it was inconceivable that you assume the unity of the history
spirit of mankind. Looking at their world, it was inconceivable that you develop a monistic concept of nature, that all is the result of one creative will. Because, yes, there is the diurnal movement. Yes, there is day and night. Yes, there are the seasons, but there are these tremendous forces which, you know, blow the other way. Earthquakes, tornadoes, violent storms, floods. How do you explain those, you know, within the sense that there is one God? And the Greeks had a perfect way. The Persians had, the Assyrians had a perfect way. The myth, the unpredictable action of the gods on Olympus in relationship to each other. That's what myth is made out of. The Jew came along and took this totally unscientific approach. One creator, one creation. Crazy idea. And it's given us headaches philosophically ever since. How do you, one creation, it works. All of modern science is based on it. But how do you explain God, how do you find God's will in that creation? In the problem of Job, the problem of theodicy, which is the basic theological problem Jews have always had to face. In part, I think the Jews came to this idea because, they didn't know enough science. They weren't trained well enough to be mistrained. In part, they came to it because their people pondered these problems in the silence of the wilderness, the silence of their lives, and they came to different understandings. I give you the nature of revelation. To the Greek, it's in the thunder. To the Jew, it's in the still, small voice. And they listened to the silence, and they heard, you know, different melodies. And somebody was inspired with one thing, and somebody with another, and somehow a different tradition. In fact, the Jews were sealed off, to a certain degree, allowed them to develop a different tradition, and it developed independently for a while. But we can't explain it. How do you explain Picasso? You know, how do you suddenly explain this eruption of creative power? It is. Those phenomena you simply accept.
What you seem to be saying is that ideas are a function of history and political events and a process. Are there any Jewish ideas that are not born of political events and political
events? Well, that's what I want us to analyze at the end of the course. And that's why we have scheduled, you know, this day and a half away to come to. I heard the question. The question is, you know, is there a constant in all of this change? And I'm going to, you know, do something that is a professor's responsibility, you know, prerogative, and delay the answer. I think that there are not constants, but there are tendencies. There are thrusts in the Jewish tradition, which are not universal, but they're broad enough to be claimed to be, you know, fairly typical. I'll give you one. It comes directly out of the question you asked. The sense of unity, the sense of oneness, the oneness of things, the vision of the one God has impelled Jews to think in unifying terms. We've never been either or next, black and white. We've always been both and kinds of people. We've always looked for community rather than division. We managed to have a lot of divisions in the process, but our vision has always been the unity. We've tried to comprehend all learning as, you know, a single body of information. We've tried to find those things which unite. We've tried to see the possibilities of two seeming opposites somehow being in the same sphere of reference. God can be immanent and God can be transcendent at the same time. It's important to be a Jew and the Jew is part of mankind at the same time. I think the tendency to, well, you see it in values. We've never been celibate, ascetics in that sense, and we've never said, you know, there are no rules over here. We've tried to find some way, some unity in the middle in all things. I think you can find a tendency of this type out of this kind of relationship. But the question is,
I want you to jump on me if you find you can after all these lectures and all this learning. But it's that kind of thing that I think we can come to. Yes. If process is constantly changing, can the matrix in any model change the same? Remain the same. The answer is yes and no. You know, I just have the same kind of answer that I gave before. More has changed and has remained the same. More is changing than is remaining the same. We constantly reflect on them. But look at, let's take one. You want to look at the matrix. Everybody reflects on Sinai. To some, Sinai is the Ten Commandments, and to probably a majority of modern people. To the rabbinic Jew, the traditional Jew, it's 613 commandments. The whole of the rabbinic tradition. To many, the two revelations of Sinai. The written law and the oral law. That's the basis of the piety of traditional Judaism. Some will say to Sinai is simply the meeting of God and man, and in the moment of the revelation of sudden awareness. We can't be sure what was said there, but we are sure that there was an intrusion of God's Spirit upon the world. That's the way some Christian denominations tend to look at this. There are times when the Jews actually prohibited the saying of the Ten Commandments in the service. Because they said you're being fixated on this, when it's this and this that really count. The modern Jew tends to deny this, tends to deny this, tends to honor this in the breach, and he has tended to develop a kind of, you know, whatever he wants ethics to be, and then to read them into these commandments. The greatness of orthodoxy is that orthodoxy knows how trivial words are. Their approach to life is through law, the hard-headed thinking about an individual problem. The liberal approach to life tends to be simplicity. Love, love, love. Tradition, tradition, tradition. Peace, peace, peace. Words which mean not a single thing, or rather than everything, and nothing. And everybody wants everybody to preach peace and love and freedom and all these things. What do they mean? Hitler talks of peace. Stalin talks of peace. Sadat talks of peace. Arafat talks of peace. What do you mean? What do you mean by love? There's love. There's smother love. There's eros. There's agape. There are X-rated movies. You know, what's love? All these terms mean nothing unless you tie them down to specifics. And the brilliance of the rabbinic tradition is it dealt in specifics. The weakness of the liberal tradition, church, synagogue, liberal tradition, is it has tended to deal in generalities. Pursue righteousness. Sounds brilliant. The devil does it mean? How does one pursue righteousness? Well, every one of us will have his own answer. But which is the Jewish answer? What does Sinai mean in these terms? The problem of defining is the critical problem, which is the problem of limitation, the basic one. Yes, sir?
How would you explain or describe the fact of Judaism that I saw in Halloween this morning in Cairo, where in the Rosh Hashanah service, perfectly, completely Orthodox, with the women kissing the Torah and walking down the aisle.
Well, I didn't see television this morning, and I would assure you that any kind of Rosh Hashanah service out of Cairo was on order.
Cairo has had, I didn't see the program, so I can't answer to you. Cairo has had continuous Jewish settlement for almost 2,000 years. The synagogues of Cairo, of old Cairo, Fashtat, are old and they are venerable and they were fairly well maintained until...